manager for the city.
I'm Valerie Feldman. I'm here on behalf of Legal Services of Northern California.
I'm Cindy Cesarini, and I work for Planning and Housing in Spotlight.
And my name's Mel Mehta, and I'm a member of the Resources for Independent Living, and I'll be reporting back.
Can you spell your last name for me, please?
R-A-N-T-A.
T-A. Okay. Excellent. Thank you.
My name is Mike Monaschia with Ernst & Young Grove.
I'm Kathy Creswell. I'm with the Sacramento Housing Alliance.
I'm Becky Craig, Assistant City Manager.
I'm Tammy Dramer, and I'm also with the Sacramento Housing Alliance.
Rachel Isco with Mutual Housing California, member of the committee.
Suzanne Kennedy, Deputy City Attorney.
Brad Kane, Director of Finance for the city and a member of the Housing Committee.
Okay, and our third member of the Housing Committee, John Costa, is absent today, and unfortunately his alternate was also unable to attend, but we have a quorum, so we'll proceed. Item number two on our agenda is the, oh, and some people don't have all of the materials, so let me. Lots of materials for today's meeting. So, and then just one more. So then does everyone have all the meeting materials then? There should be. If at some point we get somewhere in the meeting and you don't have what you need, let me know. We have plenty of extra copies here. So item number two on the agenda is for public comment. If you're here to comment on one of the items on the agenda, most namely the fee nexus study, then we'll just do those comments at that time. But if anyone has any general comments related to housing or other matters of the Affordable Housing Loan Committee, I'd be happy to hear those now. No? Yes?
I am. I'm wondering about the noticing of this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't receive electronic notice, and I thought I was on a list.
That's something we would want to confirm with the clerk. I know we did notice the meeting last Wednesday, so about a week in advance. So I think they would have sent it out either on Wednesday or Thursday last week. But I can check with them.
All right, and also to find out if I'm on the listserv or the, I mean, is there a noticing that's going out?
Honestly, the clerk takes care of the noticing for these meetings, so I know that they do have some lists. You would want to check with them on whether or not you were on a list. You could stop there. I mean, they're just downstairs. You could stop there on your way out and inquire.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other general comments? So we'll move on to approval of the minutes from the previous two meetings. So January 16th and January 28th, which was the special meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
I'll make a motion.
Second.
Okay, motion approved.
I'd like to make a comment.
Sure.
The meeting of the January 28th, the only person who was present was the finance director, you know, here at this, and also present here.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, Rachel was not there.
Right,
but
so approval of the minutes might have to be put off until you have at least two of the three who are at the meeting.
You have two sets of minutes. January 16th is what you're on?
Yeah, January 16th.
And Rachel, you were at the January 16th meeting? Which one
she
was
the
16th?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was a second meeting, the January 28th,
yes.
Which was the
which only, yes, which only Brad.
Right, so there should be a quorum of those present at the meeting.
Okay.
To approve
or we could
the
just
minutes.
Continue it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we will continue the January 28th. Okay. So we'll move on to approval of today's agenda. Do I have a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Okay. And a second?
A second.
Great, thank you, Rachel. So motion approved. So we'll move on to the housing program manager update. So this is where I just give some summaries on kind of what's going on, take care of some administrative things. One item of note is that the Form 700, the Statement of Economic Interests, was emailed out to all the committee members. And these, they were emailed out by the city clerk, and they need to be filed with the city clerk by April 1st. So did you both get the Form 700?
Yes.
I'm sure. Yes, okay, excellent. And then we each year, the city council, we provide the opportunity for all the city's committees to provide an annual update to the city council on the accomplishments of the committee in the past year. The update is usually provided by the chairperson, which would be Rachel. But we know that many of the loan committee's actions are ultimately heard by the council. You provide recommendations that end up going to the council, which isn't the case with some of our other committees. So the update is not mandatory. So you can let me know whether or not you'd like to give that update or pass on it.
I'd like to pass.
Okay. Do you have any? Okay, so we're in agreement. We'll pass on that. The council hears a lot about housing. So, and then the final item I have is that the affordable housing RFP that we discussed at the January 16th meeting is on the council's agenda for tonight. So they'll be hearing the committee's recommendation to release that RFP with the targets that you set forth, and we'll make a decision on how they want to move forward with that. So. If they choose to do that, then we'll try and get that out within the next 2 to 4 weeks, roughly.
Can I ask a question about that item?
Sure.
The way I understand the RFP process and how it requires a $5 million cash in the bank prior to the approval of that RFP or the issuance of the RFP, it seems to me that the city would have to borrow money in order to be able to make up the difference if it required that money. And I'm kind of wondering why you would recommend that. It just seems
so
the city shouldn't put out an RFP when it doesn't have the money itself and it's been required to have the $5 million.
Okay.
And why the waiver would be applied.
So the council adopted guidelines, affordable housing loan program guidelines, in 2011. And those specified that there needed to be when there was a $5 million balance combined between our two housing funds, then the city would release an RFP. Since that time, some economic factors have changed. There's some interest in developing 9% projects in Elk Grove, 9% tax credit projects. Interest rates are low. There's still a high need. And we feel that we might be able to get some proposals using a lesser amount of money. We have about $1.9 million in the fund right now. So we're not we've asked the council to waive the requirement that the fund accumulate $5 million. And allow us to put out an RFP now for the money that we currently have in the fund, the $1.9 million. We are not in any way proposing that the city borrow money to get to $5 million. We just want to see if there's a project out there, if there are any projects that are feasible at this point. The loss of redevelopment has sort of leveled the playing field for the best tax credit funding. And so we feel like, you know, now's a good time to give it a try, and if we don't get any viable responses or any responses that we like, then we have some other opportunities we can pursue, including waiting until the fund does have $5 million.
Right, and what was the reasoning behind the $5 million figure? How did that come to be?
You know, honestly, I was not at the time the housing program manager when that was determined. I think that it had to do with we were seeing the per unit subsidies increasing, and so in order to get a project with a number of units that a developer could make financially viable, we needed to have a larger amount of money in the fund. We did put a note in there. If it happened that we got two lower per unit subsidy projects or two projects that didn't need $5 million, we could do more than one at that time. So the financing of each project is different. What's viable on each site is different, and so there are a wide range of projects that could be feasible.
So then, what you're seeking is not only a drop in the cash requirement to trigger the RFP, but also you're looking for lower fees. Right.
The per unit subsidy may ultimately be lower than what we've been seeing recently. We're hoping to get proposals from developers who are interested in 9% tax credit projects, which have a higher tax credit subsidy than the other recent projects that have been developed. So there may be a lower per unit subsidy. There may not be. We're not sure. We want to see what's out there and see if there's an opportunity to kind of capitalize on today's low interest rates, and also just continue to address the fact that there remains a high need in the city for affordable housing, and the demand, especially for extremely low and very low income units, remains high as well.
So the 9% tax credit subsidy, what's the source of those subsidies? Is that federal?
Yes.
Is that HUD?
It would be federal tax credits.
Oh, they're federal tax credits.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's not from HUD.
Treasury. It's the Treasury, right. It's federal. Tax credit. What's the current status of those tax credit subsidies now? Are they not in existence, or
no? They're the main source.
Okay.
They continue to be the main source. They're very competitive, particularly at the 9%. So there's 4% tax credits and there's 9% tax credits. The 9% tax credits are very competitive, and when redevelopment funding was around, the city had. The city had some challenges in terms of competing for those funds because Sacramento has, more proximity to transit services, et cetera. But now that redevelopment is no longer around, that sort of leveled the playing field, and we're hoping that that might allow us to compete a little bit better.
Yeah, this $5 million set aside that triggers the RFP was really cash in the bank that was going to enable the city to make a loan and then be paid back, right?
Yes. The funds would always be a loan,
mm-hmm.
whether or not they get, the repayment structure is different for each loan, but generally the bulk of the loan takes a very long time to come back to the city.
What time frame are we talking about?
Over 30 years. So many projects will make smaller payments during that time, sometimes escalating, just depending on the project's individual financing structure.
What if the project doesn't last that long, falls apart? We lose the money, don't we?
Potentially. We have some legal remedies that we can pursue, but we see it as a long-term investment
most
in affordable housing.
More than that, and you have good standards, both local standards and the program itself requires very strict building code and
mm-hmm.
and management plans. And
yes.
Right. I have questions about the program, but I'll withhold those for now. Thank you for explaining the finance part.
Oh, for the loan program or for the.
The policy of the program, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, other concerns.
Okay. Okay. So then, were there any other questions on kind of those topics? No. Okay. So let's move on then to the. And the one other thing that I failed to mention in my housing program manager updates is the housing element meeting that we will be having on March 4th. We would love to see you all again at that meeting. As well as any clients that you have. We've asked our property managers of the affordable complexes in the city to post the notice in their buildings. We're trying to get as good of a turnout as we can at this meeting. And at the same time, we're also I'm also going out to the food bank and a few of their locations to try and interview people sort of where they are. So, but please, please come to this meeting. Please pass this on to anyone that you think might be interested at all. And we'd love to get some great feedback from that. So,
I do have a question, which is just to put a little bit of context in the discussion that we're about to have,
mm-hmm.
which is understanding different development was happening in the last, has the fee been around for 10 years now, 2002?
Roughly,
about?
Yeah.
Okay, so in the 10 years the loan fund has existed, from the time the first fee was approved, like how many, you know, what were the funds that were generated, I guess?
We generated about $62 million and built about 1,500 units. Yeah, roughly. So it was a very productive program.
So I'm sorry, how much did you say it generated?
About $62
million.
So
you allocated $62 million and got 1,400 units out of
15,
it?
15, about 1,500 units, yeah. So we built 10? 8 or 10 apartment complexes. I could get you the exact number.
That's a pretty significant
big number.
Yeah. We've done a lot of affordable housing.
Right.
We're proud of
the
it.
The fee, it was timely, right, in terms of when the fee was initiated and the amount of development that
and
was happening.
What's the level of affordability?
Most of our projects have a mixture of 50% and 60% units,
okay.
A little more weighted to the 60%. Because we had a tough time competing for the 9% tax credits, we did a lot of 4% tax
mm-hmm.
credit projects. Recognizing now some of those projects, the rents at the 60% level are not that far from the market rate rents for apartments. So we're trying to adjust our strategy and do more low income, deeper targeting going forward. So the RFP that we plan to release, what the committee recommended was that we do 15% ELI, extremely low income units, and 59% very low income. Most projects will want some 60% units. It kind of helps their bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Good, thank you.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit now. We'll move on to item 6, our regular items, and we'll talk about the affordable housing fee nexus study. So the city commissioned I'll back up and go through some of the background. So the city has two fees that fund affordable housing. We have our affordable housing fund, which is generated by fees on new residential development. This was a fee that we adopted in 2002, and this fee was allowed to I'll mostly just walk through this, but so we have the affordable housing fund, which was we can allocate to low-income households, so projects earning up to 80% of area median income. Although most households that benefited were at 60% because they were multifamily rental projects. The Very Low Income Housing Trust Fund is our fee on non-residential development, and that was limited to housing, supporting housing for very low income households, 50% of the median income or below. We use both of the fees primarily to develop new multifamily rental housing. And we, like I said, invested more than $62 million in 1,500 rental housing units. So this year, our Nexus study for the Affordable Housing Fund, the residential fee, was done in 2002. So it's over a decade old now. And the Very Low Income Housing Trust Fund, actually, that was adopted as a part of the county's code when we incorporated. So those fees have never been updated since incorporation. And so we thought it's time to take a look at those again. Obviously, a lot of things have changed since we adopted the fees initially. And so we hired David Rosen and Associates to update the Nexus study for us. We held some stakeholder meetings on the methodology of the study back in the summer of 2011. We went back and forth with them, made a lot of changes to the study, And we got several comments on the methodology from affordable housing developers and from market rate housing developers. And so some of the changes that we made to the study was we took a look at the effect of other federal and state financing, for example, tax credits, that most affordable housing projects receive, and calculated that into the gap for which the city is actually responsible. We removed acquisition of existing rental housing as a viable option. Initially, the study had considered that someone could go out and buy some apartments and turn them into affordable housing. We have very little stock related to that, and so for us that wasn't really a viable option. We updated the calculations to address the double counting of employees created by new residential and non-residential development. And this was a key complaint about the Nexus study. It's actually not terribly common for people to do their residential and non-residential Nexus studies together. But since we did, we had to consider that the residential development creates a lot of commercial and retail employees primarily. And then we were having, in the initial draft, we had those commercial enterprises also paying fees for those same employees. So we removed that, and that primarily only changed the commercial fee calculation. We did add some adjustment factors to account for both household members not responsible for housing cost payments, such as teens that work in some of the, at Jamba Juice or something like that. And also for Elk Grove residents taking local jobs. Right now we have a lot of our residents that commute outside of Elk Grove to work, and so we added some calculations for that. And we adjusted the debt coverage ratios on affordable housing projects. The initial study had assumed that 100% of the NOI could go towards paying a mortgage, and our affordable housing developer said that's not really going to happen. So we took that down to a more realistic level. And then what we did was we created one blended fee for residential and non-residential development that is weighted 60% to acquisition of existing owner housing and 40% to new rental construction based on the tenure in the SACOG region. So overall in the SACOG region, about 60% of housing is owner-occupied, and about 40% is rental housing.
That's across all income groups, right? That's
yes.
60-40, that's not...
That's true, yes.
Okay. And what's the rate in Elk Grove?
In Elk Grove, I believe it's closer to 7... The most recent census numbers are a little closer to 70% ownership and 30% rental.
In the Nexus study on page 15, table 5, mm-hmm. It talks about those affordable home prices. And I'm a little surprised at the very low income versus the and the moderate income figures. It shows for two bedroom, a very low income, or I'm assuming, is VLI the same as ELI?
No, VLI and ELI are different. Extremely low income is 30% of the area median income, and VLI is 50%.
Okay. So at very low, it's still $122,000, and at moderate, it's almost $300,000 for two bedrooms.
Yes.
So I'm wondering how those figures came about, because we've had a slump in the. Is that an adjusted? How's that figure?
So we calculate that based on what that income range can afford, and so we look at what they can, assuming that they're going to spend 30 to 35% of their income on housing,
uh-huh.
of their gross income. How much is that? And that would be the amount that they could afford for housing each month. And then we look at, how much of a mortgage they could get. We made some assumptions in there that they would pay annual property taxes and assessments at 1.4% of the home price, that they would have HOA dues of $50 a month, and that they would pay property insurance of $75 a month. We also assumed a 5% owner down payment and 4.5% mortgage interest rate with a 30-year mortgage. And so we factor in those things, and then our calculation comes out with what the purchase price would be for that household. And these purchase prices are pretty consistent, maybe even a bit lower than what we're seeing through our down payment assistance program. To apply for that, people have to come in with a lender pre-approval letter. And for very low-income households, I'm still seeing people coming in with pre-approval letters of 135, 140. Now, their lender may allow them to spend more than 35% on their housing, and probably does, but that shows that these figures aren't completely unrealistic. And what the moderate income here showed was that moderate income people in Elk Grove don't have a problem right now. They can afford the rents, they can afford to buy a house, and so we are not looking at them as a part of our fee. We're not planning on spending our affordable housing funds on moderate income households, and we didn't use them in calculating our fee.
Yeah, I'm just not seeing these numbers from the real estate figures that there's a lot of homes that are selling for a whole lot less than even the very low income figure you have here. Yeah.
Well, this isn't what homes exist. This is what homes they could afford.
It's a, right.
And so there aren't, you're quite right, there are virtually no homes under $130,000 in Elk Grove. There are a few condos, but there's very, very little at that level. But that's what a household could afford in a purchase price.
Okay.
So based on the data in the study and the maximum fees that were calculated, which you'll see on your two tables here, we have the residential fee per unit and we have the non-residential. Maybe let's talk about the residential one first. So option number 5 shows the maximum fee on that, and so the fees kind of run, you know, from where our current fee is, and then, you know, setting it at a lower level, all the way up to the maximum fee. And we also plan to offer two options in addition to the fee to developers. One of which would be land dedication, this with the city's approval, of course, and the other one would be an inclusionary policy, sort of a voluntary inclusionary. And we have two developers in 2006 and 2007, one developer each year came to us and did sort of a voluntary inclusionary, and those were for sale units. So we plan to at least have that as an option, whether or not, you know, it gets taken.
Is there a description of the land dedication option somewhere, or that will be
in the when we do the ordinance? Yes, right now it exists in my brain. You know, we would look at having either the city or a nonprofit partner of the city accept land donations, and then once we had funds sufficient to kind of subsidize the remaining gap in those units, mm-hmm. we would do an RFP to find a developer for that particular site. I think when we are looking at whether or not we want to take a land dedication, obviously we're looking for land that would score well in tax credit competition, and also, you know, just meet kind of our city goals of having housing near transit, near services, not on wetlands, things like that. So
that's a good idea.
So in the residential fee, option number 1 shows no change to our current fees. Right now our fee is about $4,600 for single family, and for multifamily it's half of the single family rate, so about $2,300. Option number 2 is the 20% of the maximum fee. This is what the council adopted in 2002, when we did our last Nexus study for residential. They chose to set the fee at 20% of the maximum fee. The maximum fee back then was higher than our maximum fee is now.
Almost 3 times higher, I think. Maybe 38.
It was 2 to 3 times higher. Yeah, I think it was about. We've adjusted our fee for inflation over the years, so I think it was about $18,000 at the time. Yeah. So
$18,000 for
that would have been the maximum permissible fee.
Don't hold me to that. I'd have right. to look back at that study.
I have 33,000 running around in my head, okay. but I don't think that's
I don't
it was
think
a long
it was
time
quite
ago.
That high.
But
a
all
long time
these
ago.
Are pass-throughs from the builder to the owner.
These fees are paid by the builder to the city, and then the city uses them to subsidize housing.
Right, but they're pass-throughs. In order to be able to sell the building, they have to...
In order to get their permits to build the building, they have to pay the fee.
Right, but they also
charge...
Passes
it on to the,
passes it on
the
to
owner
consumer.
Of the...
Well, not
right.
necessarily. I mean, the way... I'm not an economist, but the way I see it is that a developer, a builder is going to sell that unit for the maximum price they can sell it for, right? So they can't send the maximum price and then add an additional cost of the fees on top of that because it's already set at its maximum price, right? So the cost of the unit does obviously incorporate the cost of constructing the unit and the fees paid, but I don't see it as an exact, they take the amount of the fee and they add it to the cost of the home because they're already pricing it, I would assume, at the maximum price that they could get for the unit. It's not necessarily, it's the maximum plus the cost of fees that all goes into the, all of the costs of construction go into the price that you're going to sell a house for where you can still have a profit.
Yeah, but they usually go in knowing what the fees are going to be before they start building.
And that would be the case here?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why I'm calling it a pass-through.
That's why they like the fee program, because they know exactly what their fee is going to be at the beginning.
Right, and once it's the project is approved, isn't there a... it's fait accompli, it's done. It's not. They're not going to pay more or less. They're going to pay that amount, right?
Correct, yes. They pay the fee once.
I'm looking at the council. So yeah, that's the way it would be legally, right? They could get out of not paying it. They
pay the fee at the time they pull their building permit.
There you go.
That's it.
Right, so it's paid, but it can't be increased or decreased at that
the
point.
The fee is adjusted annually, and they'll pay whatever fee exists at the time they pull their building permit.
So if they build it 2 years later, they'll...
It'll be a higher fee than it is today.
If it is a higher fee or a lower fee.
If it has been adjusted, yes.
Okay. So we have the 20% of maximum fee option. Option number 3 here is setting the fees at 50% of the maximum fee, which the maximum fee was $7,000. Based on the 60% acquisition and 40% rental split. If we had just used rental, it would have still only been $7,900, so that didn't make a huge difference in our calculation. We have the option of setting the fee halfway between the current fee and the maximum fee, or we could go with the maximum fee of $7,000. And in all of these scenarios except for option 1, we have used the city's standard equivalent dwelling unit, EDU, calculation, which assumes that a multifamily unit is 60% of the impact of a single family unit. So whereas option number 1, the multifamily fee, is half of the single family fee, in all the other options, the multifamily fee is 60%. Of the single family fee.
These aren't the only fees that are paid, are they? I mean, by the developer or the...
Oh, no, certainly not.
Yeah,
there are a lot of fees that are paid by the developer.
Right. So there's, there's usually for water, sewer, schools, transit, so on.
Mm-hmm.
How does this compare to those other fees? How does that...
Well,
is this a big portion of it, or is it...
No. In general, for a single-family residential home, by the time you add up all the fees from all the different entities, you're approaching $70,000 to $80,000 in development impact fees.
Thank you.
For a single-family? And that includes the other districts?
Absolutely.
It
includes water and sewer and parks and fire. Absolutely. The biggest fee is roadway fee, followed by fire, and but there's a variety of them. Yeah.
Okay, so annually we plan to adjust the fees. For both of the fees, actually, the adjustment factor would be the same. We plan to look at the median home sales price in Elk Grove, the construction cost index, and what's called the CPIU rent of primary residence, which is a standard factor, and use those factors to adjust the fees annually. So of these options, are there comments on preferred options, options that aren't preferred? I will say the last special meeting of the Affordable Housing Loan Committee was held in conjunction with our industry working group, which includes a lot of members of the market rate development community, and their preferred option, they expressed a preference for option number two if there had to be any fee at all, which there was there were some comments regarding whether or not there was actually an excess and so forth. So, but if there was a fee, they preferred option two. So, what are the thoughts on what are the thoughts from this group on fee levels? And we'll be taking kind of both sides to the city council when we take this discussion and presenting a summary of.
Will your committee be making a recommendation or simply reporting on what you've heard?
Reporting. Okay. Yes. We will not ask the committee to make a recommendation formally.
That hasn't been decided yet, or when that meeting will take place.
No, it's not final. I expect it will probably be the last meeting in March.
I have a question about inclusionary housing. Could you define it?
Inclusionary housing is when the builder provides a certain percentage of the housing that they build that is set aside for persons of a certain income level. Jurisdictions have different policies on what income levels those need to be. Some jurisdictions say 10% need to be for low and very low income households. Some jurisdictions include moderate. Those policies are very different, but we would offer ours as sort of a voluntary option. I think, you know, we've had some feedback that if we did that, that rental housing would be a priority as opposed to ownership housing. But, you know, we would work with the developers on that. I'm not sure that scattered site housing would be easy to manage for any, you know, the city would not look to own those units. We would look for a nonprofit to own those units, and at this point I'm not sure we would have an easy time identifying a nonprofit who is interested in owning many scattered site units.
Did you get interest from the development community for that? Because typically they prefer fees as opposed to actually doing the units. So,
well, we have had some inquiries about it in the past, and we did have the two projects that actually successfully did that. And so it's, you know, it's a nice option, especially in a situation where we are now. You know, we have a lot of people who would very much like to buy a home. We don't have any homes. You know, we have such a tight inventory on the market. Our market of homes under $250,000, which is what low-income people can afford, the investors are picking up. And so my down payment assistance program, I have a lot of people looking for homes in the 200 to 230 range. They're not having any luck. They're putting in 10 offers sometimes, and they're simply not, you know, they're getting beat out by cash investors. So having some sort of, you know, program where a developer set them aside might be beneficial.
And do you negotiate on the, would you anticipate negotiating on a project-by-project basis in
absolutely.
Terms of how many units you get in lieu of the fee then?
Yes, what we've done in the past is looked at what the overall fee on the development would be if they paid it, and then we would look at, you know, sort of putting that into the certain units and, you know, subsidizing them to the levels that we would want.
So the ones that you did, how many units did you get?
Well, we ended up with 14 in our more successful development. It was 10% in each, 10% of the total. It was 2% moderate. One of them had, I think, 4% low and 6% moderate, and the other one had, it was 4-4-2. So 4 very low, 4% low, and 2% moderate. That one was more successful.
But the loan fund wouldn't be used for projects that had moderate income units.
No,
in them.
Absolutely.
But
not.
If they do it inclusionary, then they could include moderate income units.
We wouldn't
units.
Want to do that at this point
okay.
either. Yeah, so moderate income people do not have a problem affording
right.
housing in Elk Grove.
Right.
So, But low income and very low income, that is something we would entertain. And you know, it's the city has the option of approving that or not. You know, if what we need at that time is more rental units and we can't figure out a way to make inclusionary units rental units, then that isn't something that we would approve for that project.
If it's voluntary, you don't have to worry about it, do you? If it's a voluntary inclusionary?
Yeah, the idea of requiring rental units, right? But when you're determining like what the rents have to, but if they are opting for,
then you don't have
right,
to.
They, it's their option to build rental units. That's
right.
A different
it's,
ballpark.
We're not
ball
worried
game.
About the legal implications
right.
of it. What we are worried about is if they want to turn them over to the city, how we would manage them, because the city
right.
does not want to own them.
Sure.
So we would, if we would have to find a nonprofit partner, and at this point, we're not sure who that nonprofit partner could be.
Right.
What's the current foreclosure rate?
It's gone down substantially. In recent, so I look at the MLS pretty frequently as a part of our down payment assistance program, and I'm not really seeing all that many foreclosures right now. We still do have some. I'm not sure what the exact rate would be. The short sales have slowed down substantially as well.
But how many do we have? I mean, it's not just the foreclosure rate, it's also the number of foreclosed homes too. How many what are we looking at? Do we have a large stock of foreclosed homes?
I would need to look into that a little bit more for you. It's gone down, but I'm not sure what percentage of our housing stock it currently is.
Yeah, the reason why I bring that up is because I think one of the problems with the current methodology we use for affordable housing is segregation. And we do it by age. Two of the programs that you, or projects that you mentioned in the report, the Village at Laguna 2, that's seniors only.
Vintage, yeah.
Or Vintage, yeah. And the other, Ridge, hasn't even, I don't know if you've started to even populate that one yet over by
the
hospital.
Ridge is, yeah, the Ridge is mostly leased at this point. It's a family project.
Yeah. But it's that project is pretty much low income, and how much of it is moderate income?
All of it is low income.
It's
the Ridge is half of the units are 60% units, and half of them are 50%.
Okay, so the concern I have is that segregation that's going on. The other concern I have is that even though there was an effort to try to put these projects in, within walking distance of some amenities, they're still on streets that aren't exactly making that a reality. And I think that's one of the things that when the city council looks at continuing this method of segregation, that we have those amenities improved and modified so that they are pedestrian safe. The other concern I have is that the solutions that should be sought out aren't happening, because we seem to have stock, housing stock, but we're not. You know, it's like you say, the cash buyers can come in and swoop down and take them, and it almost seems as if there ought to be some kind of action. And we don't want to do rent control, but at the same time, it might not be bad to try to control. I don't know if we could control the sale of a lot of these homes, but the segregation that's going on, I think, happens because of the fact that the city's building these concentrated apartment complexes, and then the homes that are not being that are foreclosing are being picked up, and they're in clumps and clusters. We really need to know the number, the location, the lending status, the occupancy, and maybe we can get that from legal filings, and I don't know, the MLS probably has it, but the
There might be a way that the city could intervene between foreclosed residents and their lenders. The sheriff and police could have a moratorium on evictions. And we could, instead of making a police action, we could make it a social services referral. And then finally, I would say, you know, that there ought to be a way to have a right to rent for people who are being foreclosed on, and because they've gone, they've been probably moderate or low income to nothing, and becoming, made homeless. And I think that's one of those things that there is a project on right to rent proposed by the Center for Economic Policy Research that I could refer you to. But there's a lot of different things that could be done. And I think the housing element is extremely problematic. And if we have too many homeless people, and the homeless populations have grown, have ballooned, and it's a scary situation right now, and I'd like to see it change.
Well, we're working on that. We're opening fully in April, early April, our first transitional house for homeless people will open. And we're looking at kind of how we want to continue to address that problem. The city has a homeless solutions committee. That's a lot of our faith-based and nonprofit organizations. And we're constantly looking for new solutions for that. And, I think a lot of that feedback probably is more oriented toward the housing element, which I would encourage you to attend the public meeting, the flyer that I handed out there. I think that the fees discussion is a more narrow, and moratoriums and, how do we deal with the cash investor problem, I think is a much more broad problem than, what we're trying to deal with here with the fees. So,
but in terms of the integration point that you raised, I mean, I think two things that will lend itself to the housing element discussion is, one is, no inclusionary program is ideal, but the idea of the set-aside is that you're making housing that's affordable to lower-income households part of a whole market-rate development, as opposed to having some housing that's affordable for lower-income households here and the market-rate development someplace else. So that's, in the ideal world of inclusionary works, you'll have a mix of income ranges in one development. And then, two, if you don't have that ideal circumstance, one thing to encourage the city to do is to locate, if you feel like there's economic segregation, is to choose those sites where multifamily rental housing that's going to be affordable for lower income households to be located is within greater developments of other income levels, so that even if you feel like in terms of the actual units are segregated by who can live there, who can afford to live there, at least they're in close proximity to each other. They're both affording the same amenities. They both have the same access to schools and stores and transportation. So that is one of the things the housing element does, is to look at those sites. Where are we going to build apartments? Where are we going to build homes? And at what affordability? And to look where those sites are located to see if they really are part of the community or somehow kind of separated or segregated. Because I understand what you say about the idea is it would be, of course, the priority is to put rental units near amenities, but if the amenities aren't there, right, the development goes in and the amenities aren't there, there's no transportation. It also makes it harder to get those competitive funding sources if you don't have the amenities and transportation there as well. So that's something the city, hopefully will respond to if you raise the issue of where are these units going to go, and are they really part of the community? They're somehow separate from the community.
Right, but you're talking about residential, non-residential fee structures, and I'm wondering about the inclusion of a low income with moderate income, at least in residential areas where we have sprawl and where we don't necessarily have amenities, but at least we could have single family, duplex, multiplex homes, and they could be made more affordable that way. May or may not be owned or rented, that go beyond maybe the scope of what this fee structure has been originally made to affect. Most of the projects that you talk about with the 1,500 units are large projects. They're 70, 200,
That's what pencils.
I just, I want to just
control the meeting a little bit. I think we need to get back to the Nexus study and the amount of the fee, or we're losing this opportunity. We have only people. I think the, if you let me use the word nexus, between your comment actually and these fees is your very important point that homelessness is growing, and that we're, you know, this committee has already recommended to the council that we prioritize extremely low, very low income housing, and I think we need to bring that to bear on you know, when we're recommending the fee. And so I think that's the important point that you're raising. And so, you know, the suggestion that we either eliminate fees or even set the fees at option two, I don't think that's going to cut it, because not only are we trying to prioritize a population that needs deeper targeting, you know, funding, but also, you know, there's a building slowdown and it's going to continue. I don't think we're going to get back to that heyday. So there's going to be less money put into the pod, into the fund. And there's just less soft subsidy from other levels of government. Because so we, if anything, we need to really grow this fund. We need to have the fee higher if we're ever going to build any units. It really was quite an accomplishment to get that many units built from the fund and in the past, but it was a higher income level than we're trying to target now. So we really need to have higher fees. We're going to have less, fewer funds coming in at all into this fund in the next decade. So I'd like to hear people's comments directly on the different options.
I agree. I'm real interested to hear what your input is on the level of fees that have been, you know, or the potential options here. You know, I'd like to hear thoughts on that too.
Well, I would just start out and riff on what you just said, Rachel, and that is the issue, the law behind these fees is the creation of a relationship and proportionality. And I think the relationship that is lost in this fee structure overall, especially in, let's say in particular, the non-residential commercial retail, and then the office and hotel are 2 and 3 times higher than the retail, manufacturing, and warehouse levels, roughly speaking. And it seems to me that the lowest paying jobs that are related to and proportional to increasing, are usually related to those retail, manufacturing, retail and warehouse anyway, especially retail. And the biggest cuts are to retail fees, especially in option 2 and 3.
Can I explain why? So the what we're looking at here is the maximum fee. Those are the maximums. Commercial and retail is lower than many of the others. But you have to consider that most of the residential fee that we have is also commercial and is based on commercial and retail employees, because those are the employees that are generated largely by new residential development. New residential development doesn't generate, by and large, new office development or new warehouse or manufacturing jobs. It generates new commercial and retail jobs. So those that's why we saw when we made the adjustments to the fee and we took out the double counting of the residential and non-residential fee, really the big change was to the commercial and retail. And additionally, for the commercial and retail, while those jobs are lower paying, they also do are in some cases staffed by people who are not responsible for their house's mortgage payment or rent, such as teenagers or college kids. You know, so that factored into that production as well.
And what was the basis for making that estimate or assumption? I haven't
What's
that familiar with what the ratio was of trying to figure out in the workforce. So did you look at age? Did you to make that calculation?
David Rosen and Associates used the in-plan model to do that, and the in-plan model is it's a proprietary software that takes a lot of inputs on industries and information. I can probably find specifically where they call
that. That's okay. I can look at it. It just that was a factor.
Yeah, did they use 2010 census data?
They used the most recent information that they had, yes.
Well, going back to Rachel's question, I mean, without a doubt, I would support option 5, which is to maximize the fees. I have to completely ignore option 2, how the fee was calculated the last go around. You know, in my mind, the fee was such a small percentage of what was a potential at the time, whether whoever that was palatable and however that was chosen, that was what it was done now. But I can't consider that now, especially knowing how great the need is for lower income households, and echoing what Rachel's saying, if that's going to be a priority to meet the deepest targeting, the fee has to be maximized. And I can't really imagine anything other than the maximum fee even allowing you to, like, you know, attempt to reach that goal.
And are you referring to both to residential and
non-residential? I'm just talking about residential. I'm turning the page to see.
The non-residential, if we want to take a look at that one really quickly, the non-residential has a look, it's not the same set of options exactly. We do have the 20% option, that's number 4 on the non-residential, the maximum fee and the no change to current fees. Options number 2 and 3 leave either the office or the manufacturing rate at the same as the current fee, and then they update the other fees based on the ratio. So for example, on the commercial and retail is about 47% of the office fee. So in the proposed fee under option 2, where we leave the office fee the same, the commercial and retail is 47% of the office fee. So do we understand kind of how that pegging to a certain thing works? Option 3 pegs them to the manufacturing rate. So there,
I can add, during earlier versions when we had 10 options, the staff calculating, we had it one option for each of those being pegged off of each of the 5 here. Mm-hmm. But talking with our economic development department, our council has provided an emphasis that we want to establish more job base, and in particular office and manufacturing jobs. So if we want to have the tools available for economic development to attract office and manufacturing, if that's where our council intends to place its incentives, we wanted to give them the options here to keep those fees pegged at the current rates and then adjust off of that. So we still use the Nexus study and its logic and its proportionate share of the total fees, but that's why we only have the 2 of the 5 in here, is because of office and manufacturing being stated council goals.
Well, I would echo sort of the, given the extent of the need, it does seem hard to imagine not trying to get the maximum benefit that you can from this program, which would be option 5 in both cases. And there may be, you know, other places where if the builders or the non-residential folks feel like they need help in making it work, there may be other things, you know, regulatory, you know, relief that you could provide that make it easier. But given the extent of the need now, it has increased so dramatically since when the fee was first established. And they don't, even at those higher rates of increasing significantly, I can't believe that it would render projects infeasible.
The on the non-residential side, the maximum fees are many hundreds percent higher than our current fees. And I think there is a sense from our economic development staff that would render many projects infeasible.
How do they relate to, say, the county, you know, the county's
table?
Yes, we do have that table.
Is that part of the report? Then?
Yes.
What page are you on?
It is table A32 on page 96.
My gut is that they're significantly higher. Although some communities do,
well, I mean,
like AV, right.
The county complained that
right.
the,
But theirs is too
high. Their fees were significantly higher than, say, yours, so.
So 96 is for commercial, page 96 is commercial development.
A32.
Yeah, there's a bunch of A32 pages. 96 is.
Oh, okay,
is
so city.
90, yeah, there's, 96 is commercial development, 97 is industrial development.
Right, so I'm just trying to find the
Can we create option six?
So the affordable housing is down at the, it's almost the bottom line there. So our, right now for commercial.
45 versus 15%. And
yeah, so
10% per, 10,000
per Roseville, Rancho Cordova, Folsom,
the
and the county,
county yeah.
don't have any affordable housing works. Fee for commercial
oh, what's
development.
The city of, do you have the city of Sacramento?
It's $1.80.
Right
okay.
So, was that A32?
So, is there a chance to create option six, or this is the only game we can play?
There's a chance.
Only for the fact that when I look at the difference, right, I see what you're saying. I still would support option five, but I see what you're saying in terms of the percentage of increase.
Yeah.
I also think you can sometimes do things over a period of 2 or 3 years as opposed to just having a 100% increase in 1 year. Right? So one suggestion is to phase it in, and another would be to choose a point between 4 and 5. I mean,
well, that's what they did, or their proposal here, option 4.
Are you in residential or non?
Residential was
okay.
to go halfway between
right.
the current and
right.
the maximum.
So for non-residential, that just seems between 108% increase, I'm not certainly not opposed to, and certainly over 2 years seems doable. But to go from that to potentially a 938% increase, I can see. I can imagine the faces of some and their reaction to that.
So your economic development folks who looked at this and were concerned about five, what was their perspective on four?
They weren't thrilled about it.
Right, they weren't excited about it, but they definitely thought it was closer to the existing fee and what was in the realm of the market. So they didn't feel like they were going to hit the ceiling at 20% of the max, but I can't imagine them supporting much higher than that.
Well, didn't one of the developers at the last meeting say, gee, I wish these fees were zero?
They
yes.
continue to
yes.
make that statement
yeah.
that they
right.
do not believe there's a nexus.
They don't want
right.
anything, you know. So,
right.
I mean, this is kind of like, you know.
All right, so I modified my
stuff.
Original
formulation
yeah. and would... I'd recommend four.
On the non-residential side?
The
okay.
residential, I don't.
Okay.
And this is the reason why having the two separate meetings is just dysfunctional. I mean, there ought to be this give and take and understanding and hearing of this. They should hear what we have to say, they should hear what we have to say. And, you know, not that there's a they and a, you know, I mean, we're all, you know, I live in this city, you know, there's no us and them. But at the same time, this is just nonsense that we don't have these meetings together. You know, these meetings should
well,
be.
We tried to take the items to people at regular meetings. So the industry working group has a regular meeting to discuss various development related issues. Housing is not a frequent topic on their agenda, so they would normally be here. So we tried to capitalize on that to get the best attendance possible, similar to today when we used our Affordable Housing Loan Committee as an opportunity to hear some of the comments.
Right,
so.
But the BIA isn't here. It's not important enough.
The
28
we have a member of the BIA that is normally on our Affordable Housing Loan Committee. Unfortunately, he was at a conference this week, and so he wasn't able to attend. But I'm sure that he'll read the meeting minutes and make an attempt to.
And everyone still has another chance for their points and their sharing of their information and their desires at the council meeting, which will be in March.
Yes.
And is this going to be included, whatever you ultimately decide, in your housing element? As a program or a policy?
Yes, we do have a policy that related to the fee, yes.
Okay. So conceivably,
so
people would have an opportunity.
Our housing element is not finalized
right.
yet,
mm-hmm.
But I believe that we have a program related to our fee now, and I don't think we have any plans to abandon that. So
people would have another
right.
opportunity to address it in that context.
And when you talk about the housing element, you're talking about the general plan, right?
Yes.
It would be nice if you included that on your flyer, although you've already published the flyer. It just seems to me that, oh, no, it does say general plan housing. Okay, sorry. I'm just blind today.
Okay. So what I'm hearing is that that you like number four.
Well, if it could be 4. A or 4.
Okay.
I mean, there's
what
a part of me. Well,
a
there's
be?
Because my because I would increase the amount. I would increase the fee on commercial retail. Greater than just 23%.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the double counting, and is that described in there, the nexus? Because so that your idea of keeping that one lower was the idea that part of the residential fee is covering
the commercial and retail. Yes.
Well, it was an assumption on page 39, I think, 38 of the report. It says that DRA has reduced the projected employment generated by retail commercial development by 70% due to this overlap. But it doesn't really, I mean, I haven't found it yet where how there's a 70% overlap between employees created by new residential development and those created by new non-residential development. You know, and the argument that it sounds like that was proffered by DRA, that most of the people that work in retail is patently untrue. I mean, I think we could look at employment development department figures and see how many people are involved in retail. There's a lot of people. I mean, just anecdotally, you know, you can't go into a retail establishment and not find people over the age of 30. So it's not teenagers. You
that
know,
was not that was not that was one argument, and that was one of many adjustment factors that was used. And I don't think it wasn't a major adjustment factor. It is worth noting, but it was used. I think that the big adjustment factor that made a big difference was the fact that residential development creates a lot of new commercial and retail jobs. That was the biggest factor, that residential drives new commercial and retail.
So to be consistent with their theory of nexus and residential, you need to adjust.
Since we're doing
the commercial, right?
It's just hard. I don't. Right. I mean, I didn't do the science of it, but I understand where the overlap comes. But I don't know the high percentage of what they consider to be overlap, right? Because we do know that residential development is going to create a need for these jobs, but we also know that commercial development is also creating a need for housing for the people who are working those jobs, right? And and so that for it to be that much overlap, and I understand the idea of the teenager was not a major factor, but it's also full of assumptions that people, because they don't have the rent burden, they're not on the lease, they're not contributing towards meeting household expenses. I mean, sometimes that's why they're working, is to help contribute towards household expenses. So there are a lot of assumptions made about who's helping, right? Whether you're an adult and on the lease or you're on the mortgage, who's also contributing. But I'm just having a hard time swallowing the idea that there was that much overlap between the residential and the non-residential related to the commercial and retail.
What they said was that 70% of commercial and retail jobs were generated by residential development.
Mm-hmm.
And that 30% of them are generated by other uses. So,
but not.
And that's based on his iPlan or.
Implan, yes. And I could find it. They had some census data or something that they used for that as well.
So the question is, what
overall model is Implan.
Okay.
But the question then, therefore, begs the question: do we increase the fees for the residential or for the retail?
Or for both.
or for, yeah, I mean, that's what begs the question here. And so the strategy here is to try to have some kind of equity, but I don't see that happening when the retailers are paying such low wages to begin with. And the issue here is really wages. I mean, because the housing affordability is based on that. I mean, if you have low wages, you don't. You have low affordability. If you have high wages, you can afford a much more expensive place.
Right.
So,
and that's reflected in the fee. So the wages of these jobs are reflected in the model. The fact that commercial does pay much less on average than office jobs, than manufacturing jobs, is reflected in the fee. And that data came from the census and average for employments. And there's actually, I think there's a number of appendices in the back of the study that they go through the wages for each type of employment. And that is understood. The commercial fee being lower than some of the other fees is simply because some of the commercial employment is also covered by the residential fee.
No, I understand that overlap. However, the argument remains, or the question remains, why retail is the lowest rate. I guess it's kind of like, you know, it's the field of dreams thing. If you build it, they come, you know. And so here we are, you know, giving the lowest fees to retail, and so that's just going to encourage more retail. It seems to me that it's quid pro quo almost.
I'm not sure that giving them the lowest fees out of these categories is actually going to encourage more retail.
Won't discourage it.
Well, there was a comment that you didn't want to increase it too much on office if that's where you're trying to drive development. So the reverse of that argument is wherever the fee is lowest might drive that kind of development. So, I mean, when you look at the differences in option four, in terms of what the increases would be in those areas, you know, it's the commercial retail is substantially lower than the suggested increase in the other areas. And that's not reflected at what the maximum is, right? The maximum is, and number five is, you know, a great increase in each of these categories, not necessarily the highest in commercial, but not necessarily the discrepancy we see in four.
Weighted.
It says 20% of,
right?
20% of.
Right. So I am curious now that all the talk about the, so aren't many of the wages in hotel are pretty low, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, and in that case, you do have a significant increase.
So the hotel went up 14,000 or 14, yeah, 1,400%
as the maximum, right?
So in the next one,
yeah. So Valerie, you said that you would be interested in some sort of
in
option 4A.
Right, which would increase the commercial beyond the 23%.
To
what
level?
I mean, I'm seeing the maximum at 510, so like at a minimum 150% increase.
Okay.
And I don't know about the other categories.
And if you did that, would that require a corresponding reduction in the residential?
No.
Okay.
So the it would not require it.
Right.
These are the maximums, you know, accounting for both. And so we could set the fee anywhere up to the maximums on both sides.
But if you did the maximum here, given
mm-hmm.
The way that you've sort of factored this in, well, I guess it would only be if you died. Never mind.
Okay.
Right. Only if you did the maximum.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. So you'd like to see 150% increase to the commercial
mm-hmm.
as option 4A and leave
right.
the others the same. Okay. All right. That's something we can look at. Are there other thoughts on this topic? No other thoughts? All right.
Well, so again, I would say that the disparity between office and hotel at 2 and 3 times the rates of the other three categories. You know, the balancing here is just not apparent, and so that I would say that there ought to be, you know, if somebody's building a warehouse or a manufacturing plant, and they're going to increase the number of people who are burning better than the minimum wage, maybe even doubling it, and making it moderately affordable, you know, or putting them in the below moderate but still high low income level, you know, it just seems to me that that does a whole lot more for me and for the people in this city than just having more retail, you know, and the rates for the hotels are very high, you know, and maybe that's the reason why we have so few hotels, you know. But at the same time, I'm not sure I want to see a whole lot of hotels all on 99.5. You know, we've already got some, so, you know, maybe that rate should be that high. There's occupancy taxes, too, that are collected, and, you know, that, you know, it's not inexpensive to stay at a hotel either. But I guess I just don't understand this disparity, especially when you look at the maximum fees, not the percentage increases, but the way these fees compare to the current fees per square foot. And they're just, you know, again, 2 and 3 times higher. And it just seems to me that this is not a way to do business.
There is no nexus study supporting the existing fee structure.
Well, at one point there was. It was the county's nexus study that was done in the 1990s.
So you adopted that when the city incorporated.
When the city incorporated, and we never changed it. And so, yes, we are.
So those fees originally were supported by
some sort of a nexus study
at the time.
But looking at a larger region.
Right.
Then.
Right.
Right. And that 20% of those fees was related to those fees. Okay.
Yeah, I guess I have a problem with using these fees as a, you know, a land use engineering tool, right? It should be based on the cost of building the home, and that if the council wants to encourage manufacturing and discourage retail, that should be another discussion and another credit off something or total fees, but it shouldn't be something we take out of the affordable housing fee. This shouldn't be used as that kind of tool. So it doesn't have a place in this discussion, I don't think.
And in terms of trying to foster particular types of development by establishing a fee at that level.
Right, do that someplace else.
But the mandate from the state from the court orders is a relationship and proportionality. And I think that there is a relationship and a very strong, high proportionality of low income jobs with retail. And this really reflects a disregard of that mandate. And so I think they could actually get in trouble imposing this as it is, you know, because there is no proportionality there.
I'm not sure.
But that's what the Nexus study is trying to create, is that proportionality. I mean, the purpose for issuing a study, as opposed to just guessing at numbers, is to try to create that proportionality. You know, whether it's an exact science or not, or how the methodology is done, obviously is a big, right. The methodology you do in that Nexus study matters in terms of the information you're including to determine where the range of fees will be and what your economy, you know, what the economy and what the earning potential is and the development potential is at that time that the study is done.
Can we find out more about the in-plan or the in-plan method?
There's a lot of information in that study. Yeah.
So the in-plan stuff is in there?
Right.
Yes,
yeah.
There's a lot of description of the in-plan model.
We asked for that in detail.
Where did it lead you?
It's in the study.
No, but where did it lead you? I mean, what conclusions did you come to? I mean, you know that there's a real concern about our hyperbolic curve of retail here, and not enough real jobs, and that's been the real concern.
But that, again, is economic development focus, not impact fees.
Can I make a motion to close that during the meeting?
Yes, you absolutely can.
That's okay.
Thank you. Okay, meeting adjourned at 2:30.
And you think this is going to go to the city council for their decision making at the end of next month?
March
27th, probably.
And do you still plan to give a range like this?
Yes.
That it may be modified or whatever, but it'll be a range. range.
Yes, we plan to give
without
them a number
recommendations,
of options.
Just simply saying, here's.
Well, we may. Are will
the
we
city
have
manager
a staff
may
recommendation?
Make a recommendation,
okay.
But we're going to definitely disclose to everyone.
She's going to share what was
right.
shared here, what was shared at the other meetings.
And then you still may. You may
last
have
year, we updated a different fee, and we found it very useful to have the council really appreciate having alternatives and understanding where people's opinions.
Will there be some discussion at the presentation on this in terms of what the need for the next planning period is and what those kind of affordability gaps will be in terms of, I mean, the fee relates to something that is actually real, right, which is the need for the housing. It's not
on the housing element update.
Right.
I think the challenge with this and one of the challenges that we had is that you can't use your RENA to determine your fee.
Right.
And
right.
so having that same discussion at the same time kind of confuses people and, you know,
but
are you...
The report actually had done a pretty good job about
detailing. We have quite a bit of that taken out.
But what the need was. But you're right, the RENA is a separate...
We want to have the RENA discussion separately, yeah. We don't really want to bring that in. But we do know that there is a large level of need out there. You know,
right.
We can give information from our current complexes.
The existing need is significant.
The projected need on top of that.
In proportion, the existing need is going to be way bigger
mm-hmm.
than the projected need. So, anyway. Well, thank you. This was very helpful.
Rachel's like,
you.
Can we be done? That's what Rachel's like.
My stomach's growling. A lot louder, and you guys would have been mad.